and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, a diplomatic standoff is heating up between Washington and Beijing over new U.S. sanctions on China. The Trump administration announced the sanctions because China agreed to purchase Russian jets and S-400 missiles. But China has bought Russian weapons for decades, and even the Trump White House admits that the new sanctions strategy for weapons purchases is unprecedented. Next, despite at least 16,000 deaths in Yemen, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has decided to continue selling arms to Saudi Arabia because he doesn't want to risk a weapons deal, according to a leaked classified memo. Meanwhile, the day that Pompeo certified that Saudi Arabia and the UAE were working to reduce casualties in Yemen, the coalition killed 27 civilians, almost all of whom were children. Then President Trump lashed out at Congress yesterday for not approving his long-promised border wall. But this time it's not just Democrats opposing it. Many Republicans, including several in the Republican leadership, say that the wall is impractical, unrealistic, and just too expensive. And then today, British Prime Minister Theresa May made strong comments about the Brexit process, saying that the EU's suggested alternative plan was, quote, unacceptable. We will never agree to it. It would mean breaking up our country, unquote. British and European Union leaders met yesterday in Salzburg to discuss the terms of the UK's withdrawal from the body, and things did not go well for May. The sticking point is what to do about the Irish border. May said that no deal on Brexit and the border is better than a bad deal, and that may be where negotiations are going. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to China. A diplomatic standoff is heating up between Washington and Beijing over new U.S. sanctions on China. The Trump administration announced the sanctions because China agreed to purchase Russian jets and S-400 missiles. But China has bought Russian weapons for decades. And even the Trump White House admits that the new sanctions strategy for weapons purchases is unprecedented. We're joined from London by John Ross, senior fellow at Chongyang Institute, Renmin University of China, and an award-winning resident columnist with several different Chinese media organizations. Mr. Ross, welcome back to the show.
Hello, yes, thank you.
Can you explain to us, explain to Americans, what this new policy is and why is it? The Russians have been the world's second largest provider of arms for many, many decades. The United States saw that as business competition. Now, apparently, the administration sees it as a threat to American national security. Where do we go from here?
Yes, it's because apparently the Trump administration thinks it's got the right to control the situation in every country in the world. It's now attempting to intervene on, you know, directly military matters, question of defense, economic policy. It seems to assume that the world is no longer run according to relations between independent and sovereign states. It's run according to the dictates of the United States. This is going to end very badly, for the United States, because other countries are not going to accept it. And China is certainly not going to accept it, and Russia is not going to accept it. And if you're looking at Russia and China, you're looking at two of the most powerful countries in the world, both economically and militarily. So this is just ramping up tensions, that's all.
Even the U.S. press this morning said that the risk that the White House is running right now is being forced to impose sanctions on U.S. allies and perhaps even NATO partners like Turkey. That is certainly not in U.S. interest. And I'm unclear personally what the upside is for this new policy.
Well, I don't think there is an upside to it, because I think that this is the whole point. All the stuff about that the U.S. economy is growing very strongly, et cetera, under Trump is a complete myth, or let's not beat about the bush. It's a straightforward lie. The reality is that the U.S. growth under Trump, the peak U.S. growth, is the slowest for any president since World War II. It's lower than the much-derided Obama. It's slower than George W. Bush, not to speak of people when you had serious growth, such as, you know, under Kennedy or Truman, or even under Eisenhower. The U.S. is incapable of speeding up its own economic growth. It is complete, you imagine what I'm going to say, rude things about what Trump claims about its economic growth. The only thing that the U.S. can attempt to do is to slow down other economies. But this is going to have totally explosive consequences. I mean, if you look at the question of China, it's 1.3 billion people. And the demand of the US, if the US wants to be the largest economy in the world, is that the population of China is four times that of the US, is that the people of China never even have one quarter of the living standard of the United States. And there is absolutely no way that the Chinese people are going to accept that. Incidentally, in two decades' time, the Indian people are not going to accept it either. And therefore, the US is pitting itself against extremely large forces. And this is a struggle, frankly, that over the long term, it can't win.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with John Ross. He's a senior fellow at Chaoyang Institute at Renmin University of China. We're talking about the Trump administration's decision to sanction China for its purchase of Russian military equipment. Do you think that there's sort of two reasons, right? There's one, what we've been talking about, that, you know, China is this rising power. The United States wants to contain its rise by denying it access to advanced military equipment. And then there's the United States government sort of functions as a sales agent for the military industrial complex, I think, right? I mean, they want people to be buying, you know, countries to be buying, you know, weapons from Boeing and Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, and not from, you know, Russian or any other military contractors, really. Which one do you think is primary here? Do you think the geopolitical calculation is primary, or do you think their loyalty to U.S. weapons manufacturers is primary?
I don't think it has to choose between the two. It leads to the same conclusions. The really dangerous thing in it is they really don't understand. There was a very good comment made by one of the Russian spokespeople responding to this. He says that the U.S. is making big mistakes because it doesn't study the history of Russia and it doesn't study the history of China. If you look at the history of Russia and China, there is no way they're going to be put off by these sanctions or boycotts. I mean, the Soviet Union lost 27 million people during World War II. They're not going to be, or Russia's not going to be kicked around by a few economic sanctions. China lost in absolute terms even more people, although not as high a proportion of the population as did the Soviet Union during World War II. They're not going to be put off. You know, I follow the Chinese media extremely closely. And the rise in condemnation and opposition to the United States is vertiginous at the present time. Because I understand this for the Chinese people, it's an attempt to keep them poor, and they're not going to accept to be kept to be poor. And from the point of Russia, Russia has an advantage in arms sales. It's, as you say, it's been selling arms to people for years and years and years. And what this is an attempt to cut off, therefore, one of Russia's sources of foreign exchange and trade. And Russia won't accept it either.
Yeah, it seems to me that this is heading for a political standoff. Somebody's going to have to back down. The Chinese have literally no incentive to back down, nor do the Russians. The Russians aren't going to just shutter their arms industry, their weapons industry. At the same time, the Trump administration is going to want to save face because it can't back down now that it's gone so public and has tried to be so tough. But it makes no sense to begin sanctioning friends and allies. How do you see this resolving? It's going to have to resolve at some point.
Because Russia and China can far outlast the Trump administration.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, Trump may suffer a big blow in the November elections. I mean, already with his tariffs on China, you know, prices are going up in the U.S. If you take washing machine prices, steel prices, other prices, they're all going up. That's going to be unpopular in the U.S. And Trump may well not be around after 2020. In fact, given some of the things in the U.S., he may not make it to 2020. The idea that China and Russia can't last out for 2 years against Trump is quite absurd. Even if they had to last out for 6 years, they could. There is no other group of people in the U.S. other than Trump who agrees with these policies. Even the U.S. Congress, for example, doesn't agree on his tariffs policies. That's why he's having to misuse these obscure points of U.S. legislation, because he doesn't dare put his tariff policy to the U.S. Congress. It could be voted down. I've got some doubts that they would think that this military thing is good, because it's going to lead to a complete breakdown of military relations between China and the US. That would be my conclusion. I don't mean there's a war, but they, you know, they cooperate with each other, and both sides gain. Because the military doesn't really like things which it doesn't, you know, things which can get out of control. So therefore, I'm afraid Russia and China can far outlast Mr. Trump.
Thousands of Chinese troops participated in the Vostok 2018 military drills in Russia recently. And these were huge military drills involving, you know, hundreds of thousands of troops in total. Do you think that this move by the Trump administration is in any way connected to that, that they're sort of freaked out by this increasing military-to-military cooperation between China and Russia? They're two, you know, as the U.S. national security strategy states, you know, they're two great power competitors.
Well, I don't know if it's an immediate response, but they would be very sensible to be worried about the cooperation between China and Russia. The Chinese and Russian military together is the most formidable obstacle that you could possibly imagine to U.S. military power. So therefore, I think that the situation will be that the U.S. military will be concerned about this, and they're quite right. I mean, Russia is the one country which still has the ability to completely obliterate the United States. And China has quite enough military power in nuclear weapons to do intolerable damage to the United States, and both have extremely large conventional forces. And I don't think that both of them have a position that they don't want to enter formal military alliances. So the main result of this U.S. policy is to drive further together the two, the second and third most powerful military forces in the world, and that doesn't seem terribly well-judged position. Maybe you can kick around Iraq, or you can kick around Libya, or destroy the countries, but you certainly can't do the same to either Russia or China.
That was the voice of Mr. John Ross. He joined us from London. He is a senior fellow at Chongyang Institute, Renmin University of China, and he's also an award-winning resident columnist with several different Chinese media organizations. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Despite at least 16,000 deaths in Yemen, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has decided to continue selling weapons to Saudi Arabia because he doesn't want to risk a weapons deal, according to a leaked classified memo. Meanwhile, the day he certified that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates were working to reduce casualties in Yemen, the coalition killed 27 civilians, most of whom were children. We're joined from Santiago, Chile by Whitney Webb. She is a journalist and a staff writer for Mint Press News. And we're joined from Minneapolis, Minnesota by Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Welcome back to both of you.
Well, hello and thank you.
Thanks for having me on the program.
It's our pleasure. Whitney, let's start with you. This is a leaked classified memo. It seems to me that there's somebody close to Mike Pompeo who is a whistleblower and is as appalled as many of us are that the whole reason for continuing this war in Yemen is just to sell weapons, despite the fact that so many civilians are being killed. What do you think?
Right. Well, I think one of the reasons that someone leaked this memo is because what the memo showed is that Mike Pompeo ignored the opinions of the vast majority of all of the State Department's military and regional specialists, except for the opinion of the single group, which argued that failing to certify the coalition's actions in Yemen could impact current as well as future arms sales. And with the current arms sales being a Raytheon deal, that's worth approximately $2 billion. And interestingly, some reports have indicated that the leader of that group in the State Department that Pompeo actually listened to is headed by a former Raytheon lobbyist, which, if true, is hardly surprising.
Oh, boy, oh, boy. I didn't hear that. That's amazing.
Yeah, it really is. Kathy, I mean, you've been following the situation in Yemen very closely. I mean, the U.S. support, both in terms of weapon sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, as well as like the logistical and intelligence support. I mean, in your estimation, would the war be possible without the support of the United States?
No, I don't believe so. I believe the United States has also given Saudi Arabia cover within the United Nations. And you know, it's almost beyond belief that people could make such harsh and cruel decisions. And I think that, you know, worldwide people will be looking to the United States in a sconce. How could people be like this? I mean, people in Yemen right now in some areas are eating boiled wax leaves. We see again and again pictures of skeletal children starving to death and not even able to get to hospitals. The fuel prices have gone up. The food prices have gone up. The Saudis and the coalition have surrounded the port of Hodeidah and are continually making attacks. And, you know, the United States is supposedly sending them laser-guided missiles and giving them surveillance suggestions, and yet we find out again about another school bus that was hit, and that heartbreaking picture of a man sitting in a hillside filled with the rubble that was his home, and he's just only able to sit helplessly next to the corpses of his two children, his three-year-old son Nabil and the newborn child Sumud. Have they no heart for the consequences, the terrible consequences of these decisions?
You know, I've said on the show a couple of times, I've been to Yemen five times over the years. I went for the very first time in 1990 and most recently in 2011. And I have to say, I actually do see people literally starving to death, just laying in the street or on traffic islands. You see children begging for anything that you can give them, a cracker, a nickel, I mean, anything just to try to keep themselves alive. And that was before Saudi Arabia and the UAE began bombing them and killing civilians. And we've talked about the attack on the port of Hodeidah. We've talked about the attack on Aden. We've talked about explosions in Sana'a. But the real danger here, I think, is not just people being killed in bombings, but in people being starved to death or forced to die of thirst because the bombings are cutting off their supplies of food and water and medicine.
I think that's absolutely true, but I'd also like to point out the role of the coalition's blockade in perpetuating the starvation, the mass starvation in Yemen. Based on the UN's most recent figures that came out earlier this month, 17.8 million Yemenis are near starvation. Save the Children came out with a report a few days ago that includes 5.2 million children. I mean, these are alarming figures and account for almost two-thirds of Yemen's entire population. And then on top of that, as you mentioned, water, there's preventable disease outbreaks being caused by the lack of clean drinking water in addition to the starvation. And those preventable diseases are killing 66,000 children annually, according to UNICEF, and they can't even be treated because medicine can't make it into the country because of the blockade. You know, these facts rarely make it into the mainstream discussion on Yemen because it ends up focusing on the more egregious coalition strikes, you know, like the school buses, the weddings and funerals and all of that. And to allude to sort of what Kathy had mentioned, the callousness that the U.S. is showing in this is basically reflecting the callousness that is being shown by the people leading this fight, the Saudis and the Emiratis. Earlier in August, well, actually after the school bus bombing in August, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS as he's often called, he stated in a defense ministry meeting that he planned to continue targeting children in Yemen because he wants Yemenis to, quote, shiver for generations whenever they hear the name of Saudi Arabia. I mean, how can we continue supporting this when the number of civilian lives on the line are astounding and these are the minds of the people leading the war? I mean, obviously we are siding with the wrong people here. I think that's just extremely clear. And even if you believe the official reason for the war in Yemen, that the coalition wants to put Haiti back in power because after he was expelled in 2015 because he's the quote unquote legitimate leader of the country, why are we supporting a Yemeni leader who is okay with starving 18 million of his own people to death and bombing buses full of children to regain control? It doesn't make any sense. The whole thing is so tragic, so disturbing, and so absurd that it is just so unfathomable for a lot of Americans, I think. I mean, if you think of the number of people starving to death, 17.8 million people, I mean, that's like almost three times the number of people that died in the Holocaust. I mean, it's mind-numbing almost, and it's just baffling that this doesn't get more coverage.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking from Santiago, Chile with Whitney Webb. She's a journalist and staff writer for Mint Press News. We're talking from Minneapolis with Kathy Kelly. She is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Kathy, go ahead. I mean, Whitney brought up some points about, you know, how food is being used as a weapon of war. There's, you know, we started the conversation by talking about the callousness of Mike Pompeo and this classified memo that was leaked about, you know, his concern for billions of dollars in arms sales. But you know, there's also the extreme cruelty of the leadership of Saudi Arabia, the absolutist monarchy there. Go ahead.
Well, I think that what Whitney has spoken about brings to mind the word greed. Issa Bloomi, a professor in Stockholm, believes that the reason the Saudis want to bludgeon Yemeni people, and as Whitney said so eloquently and tragically, make sure that they'll shiver for generations to come when they hear Saudi Arabia, is because they want to do a land grab. They want to take over the resources that exist in Yemen. Maybe there's a possibility that the Saudis are looking at peak oil, or maybe they're not able to fund their new diversified economy plans. But I think Professor Bloomi could very well be right. And it's something that they share in common, this horrible greed with the United States leadership that wants to keep satiating the greed of companies like Raytheon and Boeing and Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics. And so it's incumbent on us in the United States especially to be out on the streets raising our voices, saying, up with this, we will not put. I mean, we saw it happen in Iraq. We saw how hundreds of thousands of completely innocent Iraqi children, who certainly were no threat to the United States, died horrible, tortuous deaths, the death by asphyxiation, which is how you die when you die from starvation. We saw that generation of children wasted and brutally and lethally punished to death by the economic sanctions against Iraq. We know the U.S. is capable of doing this. And so it's an important and vital time to try to restrain this unbridled greed. There is a bill that's been introduced now into the Congress by Representative Ro Khanna from California in the United States, and that might be something that the Congress could do. And I think, meanwhile, we have to press the local media, the faith-based communities, the university communities, pay attention to this issue. And it's, of course, linked in with all of the other hideous wars that the United States has engaged in its so-called war on terror, and with the $717 billion defense budget that the United States has passed. And we listen to Whitney and we know this can't possibly make the United States more secure. You listen to what she said and you think, well, why wouldn't people all around the world view us as a menacing, greedy, and corrupt group?
Extremely important points. We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Santiago, Chile by Whitney Webb. She's a journalist and staff writer for Mint Press News. And we've been joined from Minneapolis, Minnesota by Kathy Kelly. She's the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
President Trump lashed out at Congress yesterday for not approving his long-promised border wall, but this time it's not just Democrats opposing it. Many Republicans, including several in the leadership, say that the wall is impractical, unrealistic, and just too expensive. We're joined from Washington by Brent Wilkes. He's a leading immigrant rights advocate. Brent, welcome back. It's been a while.
It's great to be on the show again. Thank you.
Tell us that this wall is not going to happen, right?
Well, it's definitely not going to happen before the break in October. I can't guarantee that there isn't going to be some deal that's cut sometime in the future, because, as you know, you saw Senator Schumer and Nancy Pelosi had offered, in exchange for passing the DREAM Act, money for the wall. So that could happen again. You know, it was really Trump that walked away from that deal, not the Democrats. And conceivably, if he decided he wanted the deal after all, he might be able to try to put that back on the table, but at this point, it doesn't seem like he's going to do that.
Yeah, that's a really important point. I mean, it's pretty remarkable how the Democrats capitulated back then. And yeah, I absolutely agree. It might still be on the table. I mean, what effect do you think the midterm election plays into this dynamic? I mean, you know, this is sort of the time of year that the Democrats really want to posture, though, as being, you know, friends of immigrants or, you know, different communities that are targeted by the Trump administration. Do you think that, you know, once we get over the midterm election, maybe the opposition to Trump's wall could soften considerably?
The thing is, I actually think that the opposition to the wall is well grounded in the fact that it's not going to work, and that it's very expensive, and it's offensive. So you don't claim that your party is the party of freedom and liberty and then build a wall. It's kind of the opposite of what you're saying you're all about. So I think there's a lot of entrenched opposition to it within both the Republican Party and of course, the Democratic Party. So I think it's a long way to go. I think what they were just trying to do is give him some money in exchange for doing the right thing with the DREAM Act. And I don't think the $20 billion, though, is going to actually build the wall all along the border. It might shore up existing fencing and to create some more enforcement along the border. But I think they phrased it in a way that wasn't necessarily going to all go towards a physical barrier. The bottom line is, I mean, net immigration from Mexico is less than zero at this point, and the need for a wall has largely evaporated. The only need really is a political need by Trump and people like him that they want to appeal to these folks who want to send a message to Mexico that you're not good enough to come to our country.
Brent, in the months before the 9/11 attacks, the Bush administration and the Mexican government had agreed in principle on a deal that would allow Mexican citizens to cross the border, to work in this country, and then return across the border. They would come for growing seasons or temporary work or whatever. That was shelved after 9/11. And it seems to me that would be a far, far better idea than building a wall that anybody can climb over or tunnel under or, you know, go around, as John Cornyn said. Is there any talk at all of a political agreement here rather than a wall?
I think so. It's interesting because it's not a public thing. It's not something that's really hit the press much. But behind the scenes, advocates have talked with members of Congress on both sides. And there seems to be this idea that, yeah, once we get by this kind of native spasm that we're in, we generally have this outline of a comprehensive bill that would both do something for folks who are currently living here, but also work to try to soften the difficulty to come to the United States legally, whether that's temporary, as you just mentioned, the temporary guest worker program, or whether you want to come to the United States permanently and make a life here and become a U.S. citizen. I think people realize that the process is broken. We need to kind of make it easier. It seems like common sense, but basically, if you want people to come legally, you got to make that process reasonable and possible. And the problem right now is for the vast majority of folks that don't come legally, it's because there's no other option. They can't come legally. Even if they wait forever, there's no realistic pathway for a legal entry. And so that's why they come out of status. And that's why we ended up in the problem that we're in. And so the way to fix that is, I think, number one, you know, create a workable legal immigration framework. And then two, do something about helping the economies of Latin America. I mean, part of the net migration from Mexico is down to zero or less is because the economy in Mexico is improving, in large part because of the economic stimulus that NAFTA has created for the country. I think that there's a possibility for us to take a look at those four sending countries that are currently sending the majority of Latin American immigrants, which is, you know, Honduras and El Salvador and Nicaragua. Those are really the main sending areas. And if we can help those countries get back on their feet and do well economically, we can do a lot to actually solve that problem where it exists, as opposed to trying to, you know, wall it off and hope for the best.
The crises, the social crises in those countries are in large part, I think, due to U.S. intervention, you know, historically or ongoing. I mean, to take Honduras, for instance, you know, they're living under what I would characterize as a coup government that was, you know, installed in 2009 and sort of legitimized and solidified as a consequence of U.S. diplomatic and economic and political support.
It's amazing because remember the Cold War and when we used to fight against the Soviet Union? And so back in the day, they were our freedom fighters. And, you know, Reagan was just extolling the virtues of the Contras and the folks that we were supporting in Central America to kind of fight back against the tide of communism. And now we're best friends with Russia and Putin, and we don't like these immigrants coming from the countries that supposedly were our allies. So it's kind of interesting, isn't it, how things have changed.
So Donald Trump tweeted in all caps, "Republicans must finally get tough," referring to border policy. I mean, it's really remarkable that he doesn't consider what's been happening so far tough, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of continuity, of course, between the Obama administration immigration policies and the Republican Party, you know, Trump administration immigration policies. And in fact, I think when you look at the raw numbers, the like number of deportations under Obama were actually a little bit higher. But I mean, the Republicans and the Trump administration, they have amped up the intensity sort of, I mean, I think it's sort of the terroristic nature of immigration, quote unquote, enforcement, because it's more random. It's more infused with this sort of like ideological animus against Latin American immigrants. So the fact that, you know, he's using this language, finally get tough, was really shocking to me.
Well, I think the thing is that under Obama, especially towards the latter years in the Obama administration, he was focusing more on people that were really a threat, the folks that had done something wrong other than being out of status. So they, you know, committed some type of felony and were a threat to Americans. And so he concentrated his enforcement efforts. Thing is, that's actually harder to do than deporting basically law-abiding immigrants who happen to be out of status. And what Trump has done is, in essence, this zero tolerance strategy is to go after everybody equally, regardless of whether they've done anything wrong here other than being out of status. And so I think you see a lot more people who are hardworking immigrants who delivering pizzas and, you know, working in all types of different industries that are largely contributors to our economy and do a lot of things that Americans rely on. And so you've seen a big uptick in those individuals being deported. And I think that's really where we have to ask ourselves, is this really in our interest? I mean, obviously, you know, Trump's saying he's getting tough, but I feel like he's really hurting our economy and hurting the people here and hurting Americans. And it doesn't make sense. We should instead come up with a way to get folks right with the law and allow them to continue to support our economy and to produce the kind of products and services that Americans love.
Brent Wilkes, I'm wondering, too, if there is anybody on Capitol Hill who is going to take the leadership on negotiating something here. You know, we see people like John Cornyn, the number two Republican in the Senate, saying this isn't going to work. It's too expensive. We're not really hearing anything in the House of Representatives, but we're also not hearing anyone coming forward with some kind of a compromise. So with that said, Donald Trump says that unless he gets his border wall, he's considering shutting down the government. Do you think we're actually heading in that direction, or is Trump bluffing, or do you think there is going to be a compromise?
I think he's posturing more so than bluffing, posturing so that he can continue to tell his base that he's tough on immigration. It's something that he ran on as president, and he thinks that that's one of his base's rallying cries, is this get tough on immigration pitch. And so I think if he didn't do this, I guess if you kind of get inside his mind, what is his base going to say when the midterms happen? And you say, well, Trump doesn't seem to be pushing the wall at all, and he doesn't seem to care if they just allow it to go quietly into the night. So I think that the reason why he's doing this is to say basically he's still pushing for the wall. He can't believe how bad this deal is. Blah 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 blah. He's going to complain about it, but at the end of the day, he's going to sign the bill, and based on the promise that they're going to pick it back up after the midterms. And he's hoping that that'll mollify the base enough to keep them motivated and get them to turn out.
Yeah, he gave a speech yesterday in Las Vegas in which he shouted, "Keep America great." He was referring, of course, to the wall, because that's what the bulk of the speech was up until that point. I think it looks like he's a little bit worried he's not going to get what he wants. We've got about 20 seconds. You have the last word.
At the end of the day, it's a shame that we are where immigrants have become vilified to such an extent. It's hopefully this November election is going to be seen as that tide of anti-immigrant nativism cresting, and that what we see after the elections is a pullback from this anti-immigrant wave that we've had. And then I think then the space to do something in Congress does become possible. And so eager to get back to work on a comprehensive immigration bill that will help people get right with the law and, of course, contribute to our economy, and then, of course, do what's right from a humanitarian perspective.
That was the voice of Brent Wilkes, who joined us from Washington. Brent is a leading immigrant rights advocate. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
British and European Union leaders met yesterday in Salzburg to discuss the terms of the UK's withdrawal from the body, and things did not go well for British Prime Minister Theresa May. The sticking point is what to do about the Irish border. May said that no deal on Brexit and the border is better than a bad deal, and that may be where negotiations are going. The British press called her performance in Salzburg humiliating and disastrous, and the European press was not any more kind. We're joined from London by Steve Headley. He's the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. Steve, welcome back.
Well, thank you for inviting me back.
Steve, months ago we spoke with you, and the focus of that conversation was the border with Ireland. Here we are months later, and the conversation is still about the border with Ireland. And it seems also that both sides are just not moving. What kind of a problem are we looking at here, and why is it so intractable?
Well, I don't think it is intractable. The simple solution to the border in Ireland is for the British to withdraw from Ireland. They've been occupying Ireland for 900 years. It caused much bloodshed and pain there, and it's time they got out. But I suppose in the context of what we're talking about today is that the European Union has said that any sort of form of hard border in Ireland will not be acceptable. The British position is that Ireland can't be treated any differently from any part of the United Kingdom. So therefore, we've got a real impasse where no one can really square that circle. If that's the positions and people have to maintain those positions, then there's no possibility of any resolution to this problem.
And Theresa May has come out now, and she's said basically, she's basically given the EU an ultimatum, right? I mean, she said, well, look, you know, if you don't like my program, right, the so-called like Checkers plan, well, then you come up with something better than that. And, you know, if I have to leave with no deal, then so be it. Do you take that as a serious threat, or is that kind of just a bluff?
I think she's grandstanding. I think she knows that that would be a very bad position for the United Kingdom, for England in particular, to walk away with. I think that there are people in her own party that are pushing her that way. You've got the hard Brexiteers that are pushing her towards that position. But I think that most of Britain's trade is with Europe. I think it's something like 60% of trade is with Europe. If they don't get a deal, if they go the WTO rules, then they're going to suffer disproportionately. I mean, there'll be a little bit of suffering in Europe as well. There'll be a little bit of damage, but nothing like the damage that's going to be done to the UK economy.
Yeah, that's really what it comes down to. It's funny to me that May is trying to project this position of strength. And in fact, she's not working from a position of strength. Not only does she have to wrestle with the European Union on these issues, but politically at home, she's having a tough time. And Jeremy Corbyn himself is in a very strong position to challenge her from the left.
Yeah, I mean, I think, to be fair, most of May's problems are coming from within her own party. There are some people there who are now intent on walking away with a no-deal Brexit. I think there's about maybe 20 or 30 of them, usual suspects, who are now saying that they want a no-deal Brexit. And I think that she is in an impossible position, because if she tries to appease these people, there are going to be moderates in her party who may well resign the party whip and move over to the Lib Dems or become independents. Her party is now, she's in such a precarious situation because she doesn't have a parliamentary majority. She's relying on the Democratic Unionist Party, which are a far-right party from the north of Ireland. She hasn't got enough members in her own party. And if numbers of them break away, then she won't be able to actually function as a government.
So you think that snap elections are actually a possibility, maybe even before the March deadline for Brexit? Or could it happen, you know, perhaps right after the March deadline for a Brexit deal?
I would have thought that she would try to, if she was going to go for an election, she would go beforehand. I mean, I've heard it bandied about, but some of the Conservatives actually think it's a better strategy to hand this over to Labour and let them get the blame for Brexit.
That's an important point right there. I think a lot of people are talking about just turning this over to Labour. So what are the chances, as you pointed out, May is working without a parliamentary majority. What are the chances of an early election? And if there is an early election, is it possible that May survives?
Well, I think if there is an early election, and I think that there's every chance now, I think that it's probably more likely than not that there's going to be an early election. I think that May, unless she comes back with an absolutely convincing majority, is finished. I think that somebody else will be forced to step up from the Tory party side. But I have a feeling, and I think that things are going the Labour Party's way, despite the onslaughts, the continuing onslaughts in Jeremy Corbyn in the media. I think Labour are set to win the next general election.
There are divisions, though, within the Labour Party, right, about Brexit. Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, who's a member of the Labour Party, he came out and said, you know, he's for a second referendum, I believe. You know, there's sort of this divide between people who want to, you know, even though they may not be happy about it, accept the results of the Brexit referendum, and people who actually want to do a do-over in the hopes of sort of calling the whole thing off. I mean, how serious of a division is that? And do you see it perhaps even intensifying as, you know, a no deal situation becomes more and more likely, as we saw with the developments in Salzburg and Theresa May's response?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, there are people within the Labour Party who don't want Brexit at all. We have Sadiq Khan. Basically, he got elected on the short tails of Jeremy Corbyn as the left-wing candidate, and he's been stabbing Jeremy in the back ever since. But there are a lot of people like him in the Labour Party who don't want the Brexit at all. There are also, unfortunately, people like that in the trade unions, and they want to subvert democracy by demanding a second referendum, if you like, but not calling it a second referendum, calling it the people's vote on any final deal that Brexit throws up. So we have these people in the Labour Party, and that's certainly true. But I think that if you go outside the parliamentary Labour Party, there are not so many of them. Most of the parliamentary Labour Party are leftovers from the Tony Blair days, the bad old days. I think most of the people that have 600,000 people now who have joined the Labour Party are behind Jeremy Corbyn and understand that even if they didn't vote for Brexit, that is the will of the people of Britain and must be carried out.
Yeah, Steve, you're the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. You know, when Brexit is discussed, it's, you know, these geopolitical issues like what to do Northern Ireland. There's, you know, what will the financial institutions in the City of London, you know, what will happen to them? That's another big topic. But people don't really talk about how it'll affect like average working class people in the UK, of course, including those who are born outside of the UK. What do you think about that? I mean, when you talk with the members of your union, when you talk with other activists in your union, what are the things that people are really concerned about?
Well, first of all, I'd have to point out that my union was in favor of Brexit, not for any racist reason or right-wing reason, but we see the European Union as a capitalist club that institutionalizes the free market and a neoliberal economy, free movement of capital, free movement of labor. None of that is compatible with a socialist economy, which should be a planned economy. So we were for Brexit. We think there will be, obviously there will be some short-term repercussions of Brexit. There will be a reorientation eventually of the, pretty quickly actually, of the industries in Britain away from the service sector and back towards manufacturing, which can only be a good thing.
There's only 6 months left. It's September and, you know, March is the supposed deadline. What are the big sort of landmark events that you're looking for? What are the things that are going to determine whether or not, you know, a Brexit with a deal or a Brexit with no deal goes through? Do you think there's going to be any sort of like big last minute summits between the leaders of the UK and the leaders of the European Union?
Yes, I would expect so. Every deal that's done in Europe is done at the last minute anyway. I mean, that is the way that they work. But I think that there's been a lot of grandstanding on the from a weak position, as you pointed out correctly, from the Tories and Theresa May. And I think they will end up with some sort of deal. Well, I think that they will anyway. But it certainly won't be the deal that they've been wanting. I think it'll be a deal that's far more in favor of the European Union.
Yeah, I think that's what everybody is looking for. This is certainly I almost used the word intractable again. I'm not going to use the word intractable, but this is going to get worse before it gets any better. In any event, we'll leave it there. We were joined from London by Steve Headley. He is the Senior Assistant General Secretary of the UK's Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and be back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
It's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, and you can go there to catch up on all the headlines that we couldn't get to today. And we're also joined in studio by Nicole Russell. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of the show. Steve, welcome back. Nicole, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Delighted to join you.
We've got to start with this one headline that I almost choked on when I read it. It's from Real Clear Politics, Steve. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, I join you in almost choking on this headline. No, Trump doesn't have an anti-Palestinian agenda.
Especially coming in the week when he expelled the Palestinian ambassador, closed their embassy, and froze their assets. Right.
Yes, but you're just imagining those things. I mean, this article was so far beyond the pale, it wasn't even funny. I was expecting it to be followed up by an article that about the Pope not being Catholic.
It's just his, you know, his son-in-law going over to Israel, investing with Israel, working hand-in-hand with Israel. It's, no, definitely not anti-Palestinian whatsoever.
Yeah, and I mean, isn't Trump's ambassador to Israel actually personally a donor to these super hardline religious settler groups?
Oh, yeah. And actually, he's the first Orthodox Jew to be the U.S. ambassador to Israel.
Yeah. And the Trump administration's, the thing that they keep saying is like, well, look, we recognize Jerusalem as the capital because we wanted to take it off the table. Like, that's like the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Like, it's like, oh, well, Donald Trump said it's the capital of Israel. So I guess nobody can dispute that. It's off the table.
When Trump talks, it's just facts coming out of his mouth. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Well, let's move on to another one. I think we have to go with the next best headline for the week, which is this. Texas school board votes to delete Hillary Clinton from history curriculum. That was a headline from the Washington Examiner and several other papers as well. Now, I wish I could forget about Hillary Clinton, but that's not the way history works.
No, it's not the way history works. I think more upsettingly, though, you mentioned, Steve, that Helen Keller was also deleted.
Yes. That was, of course, a serious omission.
And did you see why Helen Keller was deleted?
I didn't.
I saw an interview with the head of the State School Commission in the Washington Post, and she said it was because Helen Keller was not a good example of a citizen, right?
Because she's a socialist?
Well, I mean, that's kind of the unspoken reason. But when they are teaching citizenship and good and proper citizenship in Texas, she's not an example of a good citizen. The military and first responders are examples of good citizens. So they're replacing Helen Keller with
the military,
with the average vanilla military person.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You have to be
honest to God's
ready
truth
to go overseas and kill people to be a good citizen.
That's it. Yeah. That's what citizenship's all about.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm being sarcastic. I just want to be so clear.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying.
You are very welcome, Steve.
Doesn't Texas have one? There's just one statewide school board, right, in Texas? I believe that's
true. Yeah, it's the state school board. And they step in these kinds of controversies every 5 or 10 years.
Right. And isn't it because it's a whole state, it's like much more economical for textbook companies to just like manufacture the textbook
that
Texas approves?
That's where they all come from.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, and Texas is unique in that it's the school board officials who dictate to the publishing companies what the textbooks will look like. Other states just say, well, this is what we're interested in. And the textbook manufacturers find the authors to put the book together. So Texas is different. Texas is the least educational, has the least educational books in any state education system.
The least educational school textbooks?
That's right.
Okay, that's kind of a bummer.
And we're going to guess that Donald Trump has been reading those books from the next headline, which happened in Spain recently. The headline, which is from Bloomberg, but was also in a variety of media. Trump told Spanish minister a Sahara wall could stop migrants. So that's his latest plan.
Hey, have you tried a wall? We're going to try it here. It's going to be great. Maybe you want to try it where you are too. People can't scale it. You can't scale walls, obviously. No one's ever done that. It's really effective, I'm pretty sure, even though we haven't tried it yet, is I imagine what went through his head.
Yeah, have you ever watched Survivor? They're always on beaches and they build these walls and the contestants have to tunnel under them to get to the reward. It's kind of funny. I can just imagine that happening in the Sahara. A minor detail Trump forgot was that Spain doesn't own the Sahara.
Yeah.
It's not their country.
That was the most striking point of that statement to me. I don't even know what he thought. I was going to say he thought that the Spanish could just build a wall across that Sahara. I don't know what the man thought.
Well, he was like, you know, Spain starts with an S, Sahara starts with an S. Maybe they're nearby. It seems logical.
Your mistake, John, is thinking that he was thinking at all.
That's it right there. That's true.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a branding, like the one skill that Donald Trump has is like branding. He is the wall guy. So he's like, oh, I'm meeting with Spain and we're talking about migrants and I'm the wall guy. So let me say, you know,
got to bring my brand
thing.
Yeah, yeah, right. We talk about the wall now.
Exactly.
Man, you're really in Donald Trump's head, Walter. That was good.
Yeah. You know,
it's a scary place to be.
When I first read that, I attributed too much intelligence to it because I was just like, oh, that, okay, the headline must be referring to Western Sahara, where Spain actually does have some kind of like historical like background as the colonizing power, and there's like a war and it's a disputed territory, so he must be saying, okay, Morocco and Spain, they should build a wall along the Western Sahara.
Yeah, that's definitely what he was thinking.
Yeah, but no, that's way less intelligent.
He doesn't know any of those things, Walter.
Yeah.
Let's be clear. Let's go back to serious headlines, and this one is a very offensive headline to me, especially given everything that's going on between North and South Korea. This is from the Washington Post. South Korea forges ahead with charm offensive to Kim regime, even as U.S. outreach stumbles. I mean, the very idea that these two countries who are busy negotiating very serious peace agreements and all sorts of, you know, positive diplomacy, to call that a charm offensive is just the height of offensiveness, if I could use the same word.
That's lazy editing. When I was at the CIA, anytime any Iraqi official would make a trip to any country during the sanctions regime, Tariq Aziz would go to China, or anybody, any official would go anywhere, the press would call it a charm offensive. It's just a normal diplomatic meeting.
It's just diplomacy.
It's just diplomacy.
That's just what diplomacy
is. And
that's
what people do. Right. You go to other countries to carry out your foreign policy, to carry out diplomacy. That's lazy editing to call every foreign meeting a charm offensive.
That it's just diplomacy. It's just a country talking to a country about the country's matters. Like, that's just what you do.
Yeah. I think it's more than just lazy editing. I mean, I think it's kind of arrogant, really. It's, you know, it's the U.S. American exceptionalism. We conduct diplomacy, even though probably we really don't most of the time.
No, we don't. We just bully.
You know, and others aren't capable. Two other countries independent of us can't really talk to each other and conduct diplomacy.
Right. Especially two countries that have been one country for about 3,000 years. And then we're sort of unjustly divided within living memory. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. It's definitely arrogant.
This other headline I picked out from Vox.com is sort of very similar. North and South Korea just signed a major agreement. Maybe bad news for Trump. I mean, excuse me.
That is a particularly, you know, a historical headline, given that Trump has been one of the only people on board for actual peace on the Korean Peninsula in the past couple of months. Even his own administration trying to, you know, members of his own administration trying to bring that, you know, agreement down.
Yeah, it is a super weird dynamic because it actually is good news for Trump because for whatever reason, he's decided to sort of stake his, I don't know, he wants like a diplomatic win and like
he
Korea
needs a legacy.
For some reason is the thing. And it's also the whole world doesn't revolve around Donald Trump.
It doesn't? What do you mean?
Well,
I'm pretty sure Trump thinks the whole world revolves around
Trump.
Yeah,
that is true.
But yeah, this headline has literally nothing to do with anything that's happening. And I mean, Trump has specifically himself tweeted, obviously, his favorite form of writing and comment. He's tweeted about how he feels really good about this, which makes sense because, again, this is his legacy.
Yeah, actually, the serious point of this headline is actually another important point to make, which is they do really mean this, that it's bad news for Trump. And why they mean that is because they write, North Korea, as a result of this agreement that we did that just happened in North and South Korea, North Korea is still expecting Washington to make the first move. The North Korean leader has basically offered to give up very little while expecting America to concede more before anything happens. Now, those things are, you know, somewhat true, actually. I mean, the North Korea has made clear they expect reciprocal things. And the basic tone of this article is, no, North Korea's, the U.S. is not going to do anything. And so, therefore, it's all going to fall apart. So there is a sort of a serious tone here, which is also disturbing, really.
There's a serious tone, but it's also the entire, like, the content of the article is also a historical. I mean, it says the North Korean leader has basically offered to give up very little while expecting America to concede more. They're already giving things up. North Korea has already given things up.
Yeah, they destroyed the nuclear testing complex. They returned, like, the remains of, you know, U.S. soldiers who died. died there during the Korean War. I mean, there were like plenty of goodwill gestures. The whole process was kicked off by the North Korean leader's, you know, New Year's address.
Walter, what has the U.S. done?
Nothing. Okay, I would say that's about nothing. So it was a positive victory, I think, for North Korean and South Korean diplomacy that they called off the war exercises. Yeah. I mean, that's good.
No more practicing war on their border.
Yeah, right. Which for some reason upsets the North Koreans.
I don't know why. It doesn't make any sense. Well, that's all the time we have today, Steve.
We were joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Steve Patt. Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. And if you go there, you can catch up on all the headlines that we couldn't get to today. And we were also joined here in the studio by Nicole Russell. She is a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Love.